The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So in the last few weeks, I've been talking about the teachings on relationship. And I've talked primarily about relationships that we have with the outer world, with other people. So I've talked a little about giving, generosity, that movement that connects us with others, and ethics, how we relate in a non-harming way with other people. And then last week I talked about the four beautiful qualities of the heart that are cultivated as we do this practice, that open our hearts and connect us to other people: kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy, and equanimity. And as I've been exploring these primarily to the outer world, but looking at the qualities we looked at last week, which are also sometimes called the Brahma Viharas, or divine abidings, that is a beginning of a movement of cultivating also inner qualities. These qualities impact not only the outer world, but they impact our own hearts, opening our hearts to ourselves as well as to others. I talked a little bit last week about the cultivation of these qualities in an active sense, talking about the practices that we can do to cultivate these qualities of kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy, and equanimity. But there's also another way to look at cultivating these qualities. We can look at what gets in the way of these beautiful qualities of heart, using mindfulness to pay attention to what is blocking us from feeling these qualities. The main things that get in the way of these qualities, there's three main things that get in the way, and they are greed, aversion, and delusion. So one of the ways that we can approach looking at how to cultivate kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy, and equanimity is to look at greed, aversion, and delusion, those qualities that get in the way. If the heart is free from greed, aversion, and delusion, it will naturally have the beautiful qualities of compassion, of kindness, of love. It's kind of an interesting exploration, and it's one of the interesting teachings of the Buddha, that it's essentially these qualities of greed, aversion, and delusion are essentially visitors, and they cover a naturally beautiful heart. So that it's a kind of a teaching. I like the way the Buddha frames the nature of us as being naturally beautiful, but these beautiful qualities are obscured by greed, aversion, and delusion. So to cultivate a skillful relationship with our experience, with other people, with our internal experience, it's very helpful to get really familiar with these qualities, to explore them, to understand them, to see what makes them come into being and what makes them dissipate and how they impact our experience. What are the consequences when we operate out of these three unskillful qualities of mind? So it kind of sometimes seems counterintuitive, perhaps, to pay attention to these qualities. I mean, I know when I first started mindfulness practice and somebody told me to pay attention to my anger, I thought, well, won't that just make it worse? Paying attention to it. If we pay attention to these things in the way we're normally trained in paying attention to them, which is to think about them and to kind of ruminate on them, think about, for instance, if we look at anger, if we think about why we're angry at this person and what they did wrong and how we could fix the situation, that is kind of feeding the anger. And so that kind of paying attention does make it worse. But if we use mindfulness to pay attention to just what it feels like to be angry, to what it feels like to be in the state of greed or aversion or of delusion, that mindfulness has some kind of unique properties. I think of that, it's almost like magic to me when I experience how mindfulness works. It seems like magic, but it actually is, it seems very logical too when I really think about how it works. But this property of mindfulness is, if you bring mindful attention, which is a non-judgmental, clear awareness, if you bring that mindful attention to something that is skillful or wholesome in your experience, such as compassion or kindness, it creates the conditions for that to appear more in our experience. So in that situation, the mindfulness does make that quality appear more for us. But if we bring our mindful, non-judgmental, clear awareness to something like anger or arrogance, it creates the conditions for that to appear less frequently in our experience. So it's got this beautiful quality of mindfulness has this capacity to increase those things that are skillful and to decrease those things that are unskillful. It's almost as if the skillful things kind of bask in the warmth of the mindfulness, and the unskillful things shrink from the clarity of the light. Now, the way it works, or in my experience, the way this works is because when we're mindful of things, we're not only mindful of the state itself. So if we're mindful of kindness, we're mindful of what that feels like in our experience. We're also mindful of the consequences. We're aware of what the consequences of that kindness are. And it becomes kind of a feedback loop. Often the consequences of skillful behaviors of non-greed, non-aversion, non-delusion tend to feed back to creating more and more happiness in our lives. And if we pay attention to greed or aversion, we notice the consequences of that. We notice the contraction. We notice the pain. We notice how other people suffer. And we suffer because we've made other people suffer. We notice the consequences of that. And the mind naturally wants to let go of those consequences when they're seen clearly with mindfulness. So this beautiful quality of mindfulness has some very amazing properties to it. So it's well worth exploring and bringing our mindful attention to greed, aversion, and delusion. So I'd like to talk a little bit about these qualities, to explore what they are and how they come into being in our experience. And I'll start with greed and aversion. They're a little bit easier to understand than delusion, but they're both actually delusion underlies both greed and aversion. So there's a way in which the delusion comes along for the ride with both greed and aversion. But to just talk about greed and aversion, they're a little easier they're more familiar to us, so they're easier to talk about. So I'll start there. And there's some similar properties they have, so I'll talk about them together. So these qualities of greed and aversion are pretty natural manifestations of the way we respond to our environment. Things are pleasant, things are unpleasant. When things are pleasant, we like them. We want to have them. And then we start to think that if I have that thing, that'll make me feel good. Things are unpleasant. We don't like them. We want to get rid of them. And we start to think that if I could only get rid of that thing, then I would be happy. So we move very naturally from these experiencing things as pleasant or unpleasant into liking and wanting and then needing. Or from unpleasant to not liking, to not wanting, to needing to get rid of. And it's that needing quality, that place where we kind of latch on and think, my happiness depends on having this thing, or my happiness depends on getting rid of this thing. That's where it moves into the greed and aversion, is when we make that leap. Now, this is a very natural movement of mind, especially the movement from pleasant to liking. And wanting to, from unpleasant to not liking. It's very natural. I mean, it's just the way we're constructed as human beings, as living beings, really, to move towards what's pleasant and away from what's unpleasant. But when we pin our happiness on the having or on the getting rid of, then we suffer. Now when we like something and we want it and we manage to get it, we do get a little bit of happiness from that. So there's a little moment of happiness, and we think that that is the best it can be. Essentially, you know, it's like, if only I could manage to string together enough of those moments, that is what would make me happy. And really, I think we're settling for a lesser kind of happiness in this way. But that's how we've been trained. That's how we have learned in our lives to become happy, to get what we want. We'll be happy when we get what we want and get rid of what we don't want. So this movement of greed and aversion becomes very ingrained in us because we do get that little bit of happiness when we get what we want or when we get rid of what we don't want. There's a little bit of feeling of satisfaction. For a moment, it's like, yes, this is the way it's supposed to be. This feels good. But it only lasts for a short time, that happiness only lasts for a short time. And so then we go off to find the next way to get the next moment of happiness, the next thing in our environment that we want or want to get rid of. And again, we think that's what will do it for us. Not that I think we don't really believe that, having that piece of chocolate is really going to be the be-all and end-all for the rest of our lives. But the pattern of getting what we want and then the next thing and the next thing, we do think that that pattern is the be-all and end-all for the rest of our lives. If we could arrange our lives to only have what we want. What I really think one of the most amazing insights that the Buddha had was that it isn't really the getting what we want that is the happiness. And there's a bit of that getting what we want. A bit of that feeling of happiness comes from the having of what we want. But a large part of the happiness actually comes from the fact that that feeling of dissatisfaction of wanting something has gone away. Of either wanting to have something or wanting to get rid of something. That is really what is uncomfortable, that feeling of wanting. So when we get what we want, we get this double hit of getting that thing. So there's a moment of pleasure for getting that thing. And then there's a moment of, oh, that wanting is gone. And likewise for the aversion. We get rid of that thing. There's a moment of feeling like, yes, I can control my environment. And the wanting has gone. So the wanting is a huge part of the actual suffering, the dissatisfaction that's underneath both greed and aversion. So looking, turning the attention to the wanting itself. Mostly we're focused out in the world, you know, looking at what we want and what we want to get rid of. That's where our attention is. How can we arrange our environment to suit us? What mindfulness encourages us to do is to turn our attention to the experience of wanting itself. To turn our attention away from what we want to have or what we want to get rid of and direct it back to the wanting, the feeling of the wanting itself. It's really quite amazing when you start to explore this. And I encourage you all to play with this in your day, finding something that you can explore when you have this feeling of wanting, looking at it, observing it. I had a experience of this on retreat where it was a long retreat, it was a 3-month retreat, and I was doing walking meditation, a lot of walking meditation. We alternated sitting meditation and walking meditation. And when I was doing the walking meditation, I really, really wanted to look at the people around me. And we were instructed to basically, you know, not look at people. You know, keep your eyes 6 feet in front of you. You can look at their shoes, but, you know, not looking up and looking at people. And this was my first long retreat. I'd been on other retreats, but it was my first long retreat, and I really wanted to know who was around me. So I had this strong feeling of wanting to look at these people. But I was a good yogi, and I just kept my eyes down. And for a while, it was like, you know, I'm not going to look. And I had these blinders on. And at some point, I was realizing that I was just forcing myself to not look. But what was happening was that I was experiencing this tremendous wanting, and that was what was happening. So I began to realize that. It took me a while, but I began to realize, there's a strong feeling of wanting. That's what I should be looking at, not just trying to force myself to not look. So I continued to not look, but instead I got interested in exploring the wanting. What did that feel like? And it really felt like this pull. You know, I felt like this pull out of me it was like this magnetic pull to the person next to me walking. But I began to notice what happened with the wanting, when it would appear. It would appear when somebody arose in my peripheral vision. You know, there wasn't any wanting. I was happily walking along, and suddenly there's somebody appearing in my peripheral vision, and boom, that wanting comes. It's like, oh, okay, then I paid attention, feeling that pull, not looking, but just, you know, feeling the wanting. And one time I remember watching somebody in my peripheral vision, you know, kind of walk next to me and then in front of me and then up the stairs and then into the building. They disappeared into the building. The wanting disappeared. It was a revelation. It was like being released from a vice grip. And that is the quality of wanting. It grips us. It's a gripped kind of feeling. And when it lets go, that is the happiness. That is the happiness when we can let go of that wanting. So I encourage you to play with that. Play with looking at the wanting that underlies greed and aversion. There are a lot of emotions that arise out of greed and aversion. And it can be helpful to get familiar with some of these and to explore these as well. And greed and aversion are kind of the bare bones roots of a lot of many, many different experiences. So for greed, for example, pride, stinginess, covetousness, excitement, insistence, exaggeration, all are forms of this greediness, vanity. Aversion, fear, anger, hostility, dislike, bitterness, rage, irritation, hatred, distrust, cruelty. There's a range for both of these, from the kind of mild, like with aversion, that just mild irritation of something just being a little bit, not right, to just complete hostility. So getting familiar with these. Now, we're not going to be able to, from the beginning, just manage to simply be mindful of things and have them disappear. We have to get familiar with them. And so with these kinds of emotions, with these, sometimes they're called afflictive emotions, the ones that really create suffering for us, it's helpful to do the same thing with these as with the wanting that underlies the greed and aversion. Can you turn your attention and notice what it feels like? What does it feel like to be in a state of anger? What does it feel like to be in a state of arrogance? So it's, again, turning away. When we're in a lot of these emotional states, there's often something out in the world that we are reacting to or responding to. And most of our attention tends to be out there. So can we turn the attention back and bring it into our own experience? A great place to do this is in the body. I know Gil has talked about this a lot, and I've talked about it a lot. What does it feel like? What does the emotion actually feel like in the body? This is a very supportive exploration because a lot of these emotions come with a lot of thoughts. They come with a lot of narrative about what he said, what she said, what they did, what I should do to fix the problem. So that comes with a lot of thoughts. And if we get hooked into the thoughts, then the emotion can tend to cycle and spiral. So if you can somehow manage to get your attention out of the thoughts and bringing your attention into the body is a good way to do that. So what does it feel like? Anger, heat and pressure in the chest. Arrogance might have a feeling of like something puffing kind of feeling in the body. So what does it feel like? Sometimes emotions have a kind of an inherent suffering to them, like anger has a kind of inherent suffering quality to it because it's got that neediness underneath it. It's got that kind of wanting underneath it. Other emotions might not, but they may be emotions that we have difficulty with. For example, sadness. Sadness itself does not necessarily have to have any kind of aversion or greed around it. There doesn't have to be any problem with sadness itself. In fact, if you can feel sadness without resistance at all, often it has a kind of a pure feeling to it. It's a kind of feeling like, yeah, this is truth. Somebody you love has died and there's sadness. And there's a feeling of rightness, in a sense, of that emotion. What feels conflictual about it is when we resist it. when we try to push it away or deny it. So in exploring our emotions, when there's kind of an afflictive or a suffering quality to it, explore whether the emotion itself has that kind of suffering embedded in it, or is it something you're adding to it because of either wanting to hold on to it or wanting to push it away? Is there either a holding to or a resisting of the emotion that brings the suffering in? So I think I'll move on now to delusion. It's interesting, in this last month I've actually been getting quite a few people asking me about delusion. What is delusion? How do I know delusion? How can I experience delusion? So I've got a few things to say about this. And when I thought about it, you know, there's kind of three basic ways that I think we experience delusion. This is just from my own reflections. The first is the basic kind of just not being aware. You know, you're checked out, you're just operating on autopilot and not at all present or mindful. There's some delusion operating there. You know, it's like there's a kind of mindlessness going on. So that's the first form. We're not aware, we're not mindful, and our habits and patterns are running the show. The second is where there is some connection happening, but it's not quite completely connecting to the experience. This may manifest as boredom, indifference, confusion, dullness. So there is some awareness going on, but it's just that the mind is not really connecting with experience. So these states that and restlessness is another quality that can often come from this kind of not completely connecting with experience. It also, this kind of delusion can be connected to neutral experience. When I talked about greed and aversion, I talked about how the greed was a manifestation of our reaction to pleasant experience, and aversion is a manifestation to a reaction to unpleasant experience. Well, this kind of delusion can be, a form of delusion can be a reaction to neutral experience. When things are neutral, we don't really connect to them. They kind of are out of our field of view. Or if we connect to them, it's like, well, this is boring. You know, this is not really worth my time. So that's a second way that we experience delusion. But I think the most common way that we experience delusion is as a view that clouds our experience. There's a teaching in the suttas, in the Buddhist texts, around four distortions of reality. These four distortions, and I'll read them, I'll mention them first, and then I'll go back through them briefly. The four distortions of reality are seeing permanence in the impermanent, seeing happiness in suffering, seeing self in what is not self, and seeing beauty in the unbeautiful. So seeing permanent in the impermanent. Now this is something we all do. It's a kind of an assumption we make on experience, on our own lives, in fact. You know, we all know we're going to die. Sort of. But it's something that's going to happen in the future. You know, it's not something that could happen in the next moment. That's a form of delusion of permanence, seeing permanent in the impermanent. The reality is we have no idea when we're going to die. It could happen in the next second. And there are many manifestations of this. If you look in what your assumptions about your experience are. You know, I parked my car out there. I'm assuming it's going to be out there when I go out there. You know, there's kind of a, you know, it's like, it's still out there. I know it's still out there. But it might not be out there. But we don't operate that way. We operate with the assumption that things are there, that they are permanent. Seeing happiness and what is suffering. This is kind of what I talked about before, that we think that we can get happiness from this kind of successive moments of getting what we want and getting rid of what we don't want. But actually, that's just further conditioning. That kind of happiness is just further conditioning more wanting and more getting rid of. It further conditions that tightening of quality of the wanting. If I want something, then I get it, then I'll be happy. We learn to want to want. So that's the seeing happiness in what is suffering. That form of way that we usually think of finding happiness, it actually perpetuates our dissatisfaction. Seeing self in what does not have self, in what is not self, this is probably the deepest delusion that we have. That we believe that we exist as an entity. Somebody who does, who chooses, who experiences. And this one is challenging to explore and to look at. I'll talk a little bit more about how to look at that in a few minutes. But what is actually happening is that they're just simply processes going on. And if you look, if you try to find what you think of as self, you're not going to find it. This delusion of seeing self in what is not self, this really is the root of greed and aversion. Because it's because we feel like we're a self that we think we have to have something or we have to get rid of something. It's a whole structure that we feel like we have to protect and defend this self. And this is where a lot of this movement to greed and aversion comes from. The fourth one, seeing beauty in the unbeautiful. Now this, I think, this one is a little harder to explain. It's maybe it's not so hard, but the classic teaching around this has to do with that we see the body as beautiful, but we're not really seeing the whole picture. And if we kind of think about what we see as beautiful in the body, it's the surface, right? I mean, it's the kind of package on the outside. It's the shiny hair and it's the nicely filed nails and the shiny skin and all of that. Would you, when you think about it, all those parts that we like, they're the dead bits. You know, they're already dead. The hair, it's already dead. The nails are already dead. You know, most of the surface of the skin is already ready to slough off and become dust bunnies under your bed. So, you know, we're not really looking at the truth of our body. And largely, I think, too, this what this is about is the way that we have how a view of something creates our desires about it and obscures the flaws in something. So, you know, think about when you were a teenager and you had a crush on somebody. You know, it's like everything they did was perfect and they were just completely beautiful. But then, you know, you grew up a little bit and you realize, well, that person was really, you know, kind of a jerk. So it was the view that you had, you know, kind of this view you were looking at them through that made them so beautiful in that time. And not really the reality of them. One of my teachers in Burma, Sayadaw Utejaniya, says that this kind of delusion doesn't mask our experience. It masks the true nature of our experience. So we're aware, but we're aware through a distorted filter. So we can be mindful, but mindful through this distorted filter. This distortion can happen at different levels. It can happen at the perceptual level, kind of at the bare bones level of our taking things in. You know, if the light is dim in a room and there's a coiled rope in the corner, you might perceive it as a snake. That's kind of at the perceptual level. Having perceived it as a snake, you might think about it as a snake and then think, oh, I need to go find somebody to help me get the snake out of this room. So those are two levels of distortion that, you know, that can come in as perception, you know, just because of the way conditions are. And we can think about it. It distorts the way we think about what we need to do. Those two levels are pretty minor. You know, they're easy to correct with a little bit of additional observation. If we've had those distortions of perception, you know, we can turn the light on in the room and see, oh, it's not a snake, it's a coiled rope. But what gets a little more serious is when a particular distortion becomes a view. When we have a particular habit that forms around seeing something in a particular way, and then it starts to distort how we see experience. We see experience through that filter, and we select information out of the environment to correspond with that filter. This is true delusion. This is kind of the clinical psychological definition of delusion, where you believe something, and even with evidence to the contrary, your view is so strong that you cannot see that evidence to the contrary. We're so sure we saw the snake that even if somebody else picks it up and shows us it's a rope, we're not going to see that. So these things kind of work in a cycle, essentially, that if we get a very strong view about something, for instance, the self, if we get a very strong view about that, we are going to perceive things that confirm that view. So essentially, these views begin to distort the actual perceptions. So all of these ways of distorted of reality, through perception, through thought, and through views, it's kind of like they feed into each other and cycle and reinforce each other. But becoming aware that we tend to distort around these four things, around permanence, happiness, self, and beauty, we can start to look at our experience in these areas. So look deeply at what you assume is permanent. Look at your experience, and where do you find yourself assuming something will be here tomorrow? Looking at that. Likewise, for what you assume is happiness. How long does your happiness last? When you get something that you want. And what are the consequences of that? Do you find, I mean, certain kinds of happiness will last longer than others. You know, having a piece of chocolate will last, you know, 30 seconds. Having a new car, well, that might last a year or so. Until the first time somebody, you know, runs into the bumper and you have to go get it repaired. So how long does it last? And is it truly satisfying, that kind of happiness? What kind of happiness is truly satisfying? Looking at self. There's actually quite a bit of evidence for not self. But I've only got 2 minutes. So I have planned to actually talk about not self next Sunday. So if you want to hear about not self, come next Sunday. But look in your experience. Just explore for yourself. What do you think of as self? And observe it. How long does it last? What is it? Just look in your own experience. There's certain things that we kind of feel like, well, that's self, but then you look at it and it's like, well, oh no, that goes away. Look in your experience at what you think is self. And notice whether it lasts. So I should stop. So I'll just close by pointing back to the fact that observing greed, aversion, and delusion is one way to begin to loosen their grip on us. This power of mindfulness, it has that power to kind of loosen the ties that this wanting has on us. And as those loosen, we begin to experience more of the happiness that is not the result of getting something, but the result of letting something go. So Gil will be back next week. This is my last Monday night talk for a while. And I wanted to express my appreciation for being here with you. I've really enjoyed this Monday evening class. So thank you all. Thank you.